Golf Smarter number 103 for December 4, 2007.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
The rebirth of a golf course with architect Forrest Richardson.
This is Golf Smarter. Each week, we tap the minds of PGA and USGA course pros, architects, authors, and teaching gurus to provide you with tips, drills, insights, and advice so that you can lower your scores. Golf Smarter is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us for another Golf Smarter podcast. Today, Kenny Nicholson of Edwin Watts Golf will review the new Mizuno MP600 driver and choose the winner of the OGIO bag of your choice. Our guest today is Forrest Richardson, who is an accomplished course architect and author. Forrest and I sat down just before the press briefing at Peacock Gap Golf Course. Peacock Gap has been closed since April of 2007 and was finally about to reopen the following day after a multi-million dollar renovation. In the past few years, Peacock has fallen out of favor to the locals because of poor course conditions, unimpressive customer service, bad word of mouth, and better course choices in Marin County, California. If you have a local course that has similar problems, then this is a really interesting conversation on the history and rebirth of a property that has a ton of potential. Usually, we would direct you to Google Earth to review the holes that Forrest talks about, but the changes are so new that the views you'd get on Google Earth wouldn't do the renovation justice. I'll let you know what I thought of the course after we talk to Kenny. Welcome, Forrest.
Well, good morning.
We're here at Peacock Gap in San Rafael, California, and you're just finishing this project, and you're opening it up to the public. Give me a history of Peacock and why it came to the point where it needed to be renewed, revamped.
Well, like almost every golf course, in fact, every golf course, there's a lifespan. People think that when you finish a golf course, it's just there, and it's good forever. But they're living, breathing things. They're a lot like raising kids. You know, the cost of a golf course isn't the hospital stay and the obstetrician. You know, it's the college and the nurturing and the putting through school and all of that. And golf courses are the same way. And especially courses in the 50s, 60s, and 70s are just now in America coming to realize that the infrastructure and everything is shot, that, you know, they haven't really been replenished over the years, a good way to put it. Peacock was exactly that. The owners of Peacock Gap over the last 30 years, the previous owners, had just let things, you know, fall apart. And the economy was part of that. So too was this whole notion that, you know, golf courses last forever. So, make a long story short, Peacock, great, wonderful location, you know, right here in Marin, 15 minutes or less north of the Golden Gate Bridge, and the new owners asked me to come in and basically give them an assessment. Would this make a great golf course if we, you know, put some cash into it and did the right thing? So what we did here was what we're doing to a lot of courses from that era, and that is reinventing them, basically. And so that's the story of how we got to today was really number one, a need, and number two, this just incredible site. And by the way, today is an incredible day. I'm very happy about
and
that,
because we're just,
I don't know,
minutes away from December, and it's a spectacular
I don't know if degrees, you know, today. This time of year in San Francisco Bay Area, it can be rainy, and and we did have some rain during construction, which was good and welcomed, and
that doesn't slow things down much when you
it didn't actually, because it was a nice drizzle. It would rain for a few days like it does here and then clear up, and you know, that kept the dust down and the neighbors happy, and so it made our life a little easier.
And you are surrounded by a community here.
Peacock is very interesting in that it's a core golf course, meaning it's a central park, if you will, to this neighborhood called Peacock Gap. And it's surrounded by hills, and it's just the perfect golf site. You know, it's actually the kind of golf site that we're seeing a return to by developers, where instead of running a golf hole down the middle of houses, you know, I call it the slice houses and the hook houses. instead of doing that, we're seeing more and more developers come to us and say, hey, you know, Forrest, can you guys lay out a golf course that's more of a core, you know, self-contained course, and maybe we'll just put the houses around the outside. And that's what Peacock was, and that The developers back in the 60s had this great vision of taking this low valley, you know, with the one little or two little hills, the one out on the course and then the one where we are here at the clubhouse, and building a golf course down in the valley and then surrounding it by these homes that would all pretty much look over the golf course.
So when you were being courted to do the renovation here, you said the word cash. I heard that.
Yep, yep. That's
got to be a critical element for you to decide whether or not that you're interested in a project of what kind of money it's going to take to
Well,
to
it
move
is,
forward.
Except, you know, I tell people, and I firmly believe this, I've been in design all my life, started in television many years ago in television design and animation, and then made the transformation up to golf courses or over to golf courses. I don't know if it's up or not, but the idea of budget being some end-all solution is not a good, you know, way to think of things. However, when you do have a golf course that has a lot of infrastructure problems, you know, that irrigation, drainage, turf quality issues, absolutely, the commitment by the new owners to correct those things was very important to us. You know, they could have come in here and just remodeled bunkers and done a little work on the greens, but that clearly wasn't the right thing to do, and I told them that. And the results, I think, speak for themselves. You know, we basically have a new golf course here. It still pays homage to the legacy that was here early on, but it's completely new and exciting.
And how important is that legacy to you?
It's important because I think that I think we've actually moved from the experience economy, which was written about, you know, a decade ago, to really this economy of authenticity. I think there's a huge interest and among golfers and today's society to be a part of something real. And, you know, you can Disneyfy it and create stuff, okay? And I've worked for Disney, and I respect what they do. But I think even at the Disney parks, you're seeing a return to what's authentic is really selling. And so here at Peacock Gap, we began with this notion of William F. Bell, the original architect, 1960. And we looked at the Bell legacy. His father, William P. Bell, was one of the most famous of all Western golf course architects. You know, he worked with George Thomas on Riviera and Bel Air and left his mark all across California and the West. And so that's where we began. We looked at that first and we said, is there something here? Can we take Peacock Gap and do several things, reinvent it, you know, make it palatable to today's market, and make something exciting that, you know, people will want to come to and be a member of and visit. And at the same time, can we take something and also have this, you know, lineage to the Bell legacy? And I think we've done that. That was our goal, and I'm real proud of what we were able to do, because it to me looks like a William Bell golf course.
Well, that's my next question was going to be, did you want to turn this into an enhanced Bell golf course, or did you want it to be a Bell Richardson golf course?
Well, I'll let people decide if they, you know, I mean, as much as we love to have our name associated with work, clearly here the approach was to create a golf course that had this faithful link to the past of the Bells, both of them. Now, the senior Bell didn't have anything to do with Peacock, but he certainly raised his son and brought him into the design business. And so what we did at Peacock is we said, well, you know, what if we took this golf course, this wonderful setting, and actually used the Bell design philosophy, both senior and junior, to create a golf course that maybe had much more of a classic feel, something that maybe looks like it could have been from the 30s. What we call the golden age of golf course architecture. And so that's what we tried to do, and I think that's what we've done. And the greens are very bold. The holes and the bunkers all have this very classic look and feel to them. And one of the things that we worked very diligently to do is to give options to the golfer, so that instead of telling the golfer how to play a hole, we ask the golfer the question, how would you like to attack this hole, Mr. or Mrs. Golfer? You know, what would you like to do here? Would you like to lay up, hit left, hit right, hit a little further right, try to outdrive that bunker? And by the way, there's about 7 or 8 ways to come into the green. We'd like you to think about that, too. And anytime, I think this is important to golf architecture, anytime we can put a question in the golfer's mind. What we've done is we've really opened the golf course up to interpretation, which is the fun part of golf. How do I play the hole? One of the worst things in a golf course is to stand up on the tee and only have one way to play it.
Which I think, and I'm very familiar with this course, I think there was a lot of that on this golf course. What dictates for you how you need to make changes on a hole? And when you have a course that was, I always felt this course was great for the ego. When I wasn't playing well, go to Peacock, you'll shoot a great round, you'll feel much better, and you'll want to go out and play again.
Well, I think you'll still be able to do that. I think though that you'll...
I don't know. I've looked at a couple of these greens. They're very different.
They are different, and the greens are a whole topic here, which I think is that's something that's really been lost in a lot of American golf course design is that over the years we've homogenized our greens. We've got them putting so fast, you know, and rolling so fast that we can't create these big, bold contours that were such a rich part of the game.
There was a joke around here that always ran through is that when you play Peacock, the tee boxes are mounded and the greens are flat.
I hadn't heard it put that way, but that's pretty accurate. I think to answer your original question about how we go about transforming these holes, one of the big challenges at Peacock was that we had tree-lined fairways. Where they were what I call very penal. In other words, trees left, trees right. When you stood on the tee, it was just like I said earlier, there's only one way to play the golf hole, straight down the middle. If you hit it under a tree, well, you got to recover, and you don't even have to think about that. What we've tried to do and what we've done on many of these holes, even though it's a tight site, is we've opened up the fairways. We've gone through and removed a huge number of the non-indigenous trees, especially, you know, the ones that really don't belong here in Marin County. And we've left the heritage trees, you know, certainly the oaks and many of the pines and redwoods. Those have been left in place. So it's still a parkland, you know, course. It's still a walk in the park. But there's more room now. So when you're on the tee, you've got to think. And the interesting thing is that room and width on a golf course is better for the player that doesn't have all the skill sets. Okay, so the higher handicapper golfer finds that a welcoming relief to have width. The better golfer, interestingly, the lower handicapper, the single digit, you know, golfer, they find it maddening because they can hit the ball straight. And if there's trees left and right and there's 150 feet to hit the ball, they only have to do one thing when they get on the tee. They might take an iron or fairway wood. But now with width, all sorts of decisions. That the better golfer is the one that's planning ahead, you know, that's thinking about, well, how do I want to come into the green? Where's the pin today? And so this is the thing that we try for, not just on renovation projects like Peacock, but also on new course designs that we do in our office is really creating this idea that options are a part of the game and that holes shouldn't be, we shouldn't give a set of instructions that someone comes to the tee and they say, hey, Mr. Golfer, there's only one way to play this hole, and that's to grab this club and hit this shot, and if you don't, you lose.
I love to have conversations with architects to talk about strategy and how strategy is designed, but how you can relate that to the hacker, to the average golfer out there.
You and
there.
I both. You mean
exactly.
The hacker?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, we don't talk to people who have single-digit handicaps because there aren't that many, and they don't want to be told anything anyway because they know what they're doing. But the rest of us would love to get some tips and advice on strategically playing a hole. When you're designing, how does that come into play for you, and what should we be looking for through your eyes?
Well, I don't consciously design to my game, although I've probably been accused of that on a few occasions. I think the one comment I get from the way I design golf courses is that I'm not afraid to hide part of the green or part of the target. I don't do that on every hole, on every course, but I think that's part of the mystery of the game that's also missing from this homogenized idea of American golf is that for
all
years,
those people with those Bushnell rangefinders are not happy about that.
Well, you know, here at Peacock we have one hole in particular, number 7, that has a big landform, a dell, if you will, or a little hill in front of the green with a huge bunker carved into it. And that short par 4, if you don't hit your tee shot just in the right place, depending on where the pin is, you're going to have a blind or partially blind shot, you know, to the green. But the idea is that you have a choice. You know, you can play to the left and hit a 8-iron into the green. You don't have to hit that big long drive and take the chance of being blinded by that knoll. But I think that the strategy advice that I could give any golfer as an architect would be to really try to read the golf hole and think of it as a puzzle. And it gets into the idea of planning ahead, which is what I said a few minutes ago. With this idea of the better golfer that has the lower handicap is going to be the player that plans ahead. Think of it as a caddy, for example. I mean, even the better player, I think, perhaps talks to themselves a little bit about, okay, what's next? Let's plan ahead here. Let's get a game plan of how we're going to save par or how we're going to, you know, try to better our score or get out of this difficulty or whatever. And I think that sometimes the higher handicap player, it becomes an exponential problem. I know in my own game, you know, when things go wrong, I don't have time to be thinking ahead, you know. So the best advice I could give would be to think of a golf hole as a puzzle and to know when to not hit that shot that, you know. I mean, a lot of golfers I see, I play with a lot of golfers, and one thing I see all the time is, you know, hitting the ball, let's say, to within 50, 60, 70 yards of a target, which to me is one of the most difficult shots in golf because now you're under a wedge and you have all these variables. Do I hit it hard? Do I hit it three quarters? Do I hit it half? Do I hit it low? Do I hit it high? You know, what do I do? Whereas almost every golfer can hit that 100-yard, 110-yard shot with a fair degree of consistency. You know, I mean, it's a wedge and a 9-iron are pretty standard shots. So, again, that comes into planning ahead. You know, maybe the better play is not to hit the ball far, but to hit it into a position, you know, that you can execute the hole and if you will, beat the puzzle or figure the puzzle out. And I think that whole notion of a puzzle is really the best concept that, you know, with my daughter, for example, you know, when I introduced her to golf, she's 12 now, I talked a lot about that. You know, hey, these are puzzles to figure out. And so what's interesting is she's carried that with her. You know, now when she does play golf, she, you know, looks at the golf hole and she thinks, okay, how do I want to attack this?
And start at the tee box, looking down, and then actually position yourself from the flag and work backwards, or which way would you create that puzzle?
I think it's everyone has a different way of solving a puzzle, but yeah, that's how I do it. We design golf courses pretty much thinking of how the golfer is going to be faced with the puzzle. So, you know, we might begin with the green because the green site nature dictates. That might be a logical place for us to begin, but at some point we begin thinking of the golf hole from the way the player is going to look at it.
Well, now, boy, I have a couple questions I want to go to because, but I'm going to take what you just said. And in your design, do you work from the green of the 18th and go backwards, or I mean, do you start? You just said how a green dictates where the hole is going to be.
Well, it can. In a natural site, like down in Mexico, we finished a course about a year and a half ago called the Lynx at Las Palomas, which is all in the sand dunes on the eastern side of the Sea of Cortez, just south of the Arizona border. And it's a true Lynx course. And when we first investigated that site for the developer, we found probably 20 or 30 wonderful big pockets in the dunes to put greens. And so we identified those on the plan, and that became sort of the starting point that we began to lay out the golf course. Routing a golf course is a complicated matter. I wrote an entire book about it 5 or 6 years ago called Routing the Golf Course.
The name of the book?
That's the name of the book. And it's one of those, I know you can find it anywhere. It's one of those obscure titles, though, that, you know, it's more like a textbook or a reference work.
Audience loves that stuff.
Yeah, well, you know.
Is it available on Amazon?
It is, yeah.
Okay,
it is.
Then we'll be able to find it for you.
Yeah,
okay.
And there's still some in the warehouse, although it's actually been a good seller in the golf industry throughout the world. But Routing the Golf Course forced me to write down my thoughts on how to lay out a golf course. And one of the most interesting pieces of advice I got in writing that book came from the late Desmond Muirhead. Of course, he was alive at the time, and Desmond was a great friend and a golf course architect, one of the truly gifted people in our business that was really responsible for the modern development and how we lay out communities and things. But Desmond told me once, he said, Forrest, most people can't get more than one hole, golf hole in their head at any one time. And he said the gift of being able to route a golf course and, you know, think of all 18 holes is this amazing ability that you gain over the years to be able to think of more than one hole at a time. And so what you just said about how do you go about, you know, you've got to think of things hole at a time, shot at a time, green sight, but at some point you've got to connect them all together. As another wise golf course architect said, Bill Amick out of Florida, he said to me, what goes out must come back. You know, we don't usually have the ability to just say, well, here's 18 great greens. We'll just design a golf course. And so what? You're 3.5 miles away from the clubhouse. That's okay. really what we do is there's a lot of compromises that go into routing a golf course. And what we try to do is minimize those. So at the end of the day, I think the greatest golf courses in the world and the ones that are fun and interesting and people love to come back to are the ones that you look at. And really the way to describe them is very few compromises.
Mm.
You know, I mean, Pebble Beach is a good example. A lot of people have said it's a great, well, there's been a lot of criticism over the years. Hey, it's a great 9-hole golf course and whatever. I don't buy that. I think Pebble is one of the most fascinating courses anywhere. But it does have some compromises.
Explain, you know, fascinating.
Well, fascinating, I think the way Pebble touches the water and then goes inland and then comes back to the water. Of course, the spectacular holes are part of Pebble. You can't beat the, you know, the stretch of holes along the ocean and the finishing holes along the ocean. But I think that, like Cypress Point and so many other great golf courses, the routing is the heart and soul, the bones, the anatomy of a golf course. That was another quote that Desmond Muirhead said, is that, you know, the routing of a golf course is the anatomy. It's the bones. It's like a beautiful woman. The anatomy and the structure is what makes the beauty, you know, and everything else is just makeup and skin and texture. And a lot of that's true in golf. And I think this idea of routing, of how we connect the holes together, that starts to form the poem, the story, the pace. So you look at any great story, whether it's Steinbeck or, you know, whoever you like as an author, it was the way that was presented that makes it so great. In addition, of course, to the details, you know, and Steinbeck would be a great example of the details. But in the case of a golf course, the rhythm, the pace, the flow, the way we go from a 3 to a 4 to a 5 and another couple of 4s, the way we go in the forest and come back out, and we get a view of a, like here at Peacock, the lagoon, you know, so we see the lagoon at number 4, and then we turn back away from it, and we have this little mystery for several holes, and then voila, at number 16, we're back to the lagoon, and we not only get to see it this time, but we actually get to taste it. And that actually is fascinating, because I think the golfer anticipates that 16th hole, you know. Probably no greater example than that is Pete Dye's TPC in Sawgrass, where the 17th hole, this short little hole with the island green, is the most maddening hole in the round, not because necessarily of its length or its difficulty. When you really add it all up, it's not that difficult a golf hole, but the golfer has to think about it for an entire 3.5 hour period.
That's really interesting, the psychology of the design there.
Exactly. It's kind of like that test, you know. I mean, here I am in a semester of a hard class, but I have to think about the term paper. Well, the term paper at the TPC is number 17, and the term paper here at Peacock is without any doubt 16 and 17 both, because at 16 we have this hole across the lagoon where we brought the green right down to the edge of the water. And then at 17 we have a par 4 that plays to the edge of a canal. And I think those two holes are going to be things that the repeat player here at Peacock begins to think about more and more as the round gets, you know, further along.
Absolutely. How does technology and new technology on balls that go farther and clubs that allow you to hit longer and straighter, how does that impact your design these days?
Well, it impacts it. We have to think about it. Interestingly, the average golfer really isn't hitting the ball consistently further. They're hitting the ball a little further. But what the real amazing part of technology is that now the average golfer has the ability to really pound one every once in a while. And that's concerning to us, because what used to be a landing area maybe of 220 or 30 yards today is a little longer on occasion. So what we try to do, at least my philosophy, is that we try to think of, you know, more than half the game is played around the green. So what we try to do is think of the short game and playing the game around the green.
Five more? Can we get five more minutes? Because I want to talk about
Peacock. We start at 10:30? 10:30? I'll be right in. Yep. I think the idea is that our philosophy is to focus on the short game. And so what's become a real trademark of our work over the last 10 years has been greens that are interesting, unique. They're not all the same. There's maybe a consistency and a common thread to them in one respect. But Peacock is a great example where the 14th green is absolutely diabolically different than the 12th green. And yet there's a common thread to them. You know, it's they putt the same. They're the same turf. They have similar look and feel around them. But the green itself is a puzzle in itself. So it's like once you get to one layer, it's kind of like these video games that kids play. You know, it's like once you get to one layer on Xbox, you go to the next layer. Well, I think our trademark has become looking at golf holes that way. In other words, give them a choice off the tee, create some options coming into the green on the approach, and then create an interesting situation at the green itself.
Let's talk about a couple of the holes here because we're being you need to do a press conference here, and I appreciate your time. This has really been fascinating to me. Let's talk about a couple of the holes and what the demands were and what changes you had to make this a more inviting course for locals and for people who are visiting San Francisco and looking for a course to play.
Well, the first thing is we wanted to – any golf course, in my opinion, should be a fun golf course. And my mentor, Arthur Jack Snyder, who passed away in 2005 – he drove that into me for 20-some years. You know, Forest Golf Course, golf's meant to be a fun game. You know, it's our job to make it fun for people. So I have a sense of humor. I think Peacock has, at a few places, a sense of humor. Number 10, I think one of my favorite greens I've ever done, which has the little thumbprint or the dimple in it. You can putt through the dimple. You can putt around it. You can put a pin in front of it, beside it. I make the joke here that someday I'm going to make sure the pin gets put in the dimple so that I can get my first hole in one. But to describe it to the listeners, it's about a 2-foot deep depression in the green, and it's about as big as a little play pool, and it just gracefully drops into this little dimple. But it, to me, that's just a fun, interesting green. Number 14 is called the Groove, and that green has a big swale that goes linearly down the middle. And it's wild. Number 11 is a bottleneck green, which is a pretty traditional green if you look at classic golf architecture, but you don't see it a lot anymore. It's a big hourglass-shaped green. Number 7 is a Biritz green, which was named the Biritz hole was from Biritz, France, and it was a hole with a huge swale in the green going left to right, sort of perpendicular to the golfer, and it usually the Biritz played across a big canyon. What we did at 7 was take a par 4, and we did a Biritz green, but we turned it. So we put it perpendicular to the golfer. So this, you have an upper level on the right and left, and then a big swale in the middle of the green, and that green is different. So, you know, there are interesting holes at Peacock. Hopefully every hole is unique and different. You know, none are play alike. They're all different. But, again, it's that idea of having these levels. So when you get to the green, you also have variation in the greens. And hopefully a lot of fun and a lot of local knowledge. Oakmont, where Arthur Jack Snyder, my mentor, grew up and was actually superintendent there, and he was a guy from western Pennsylvania. Oakmont is probably no better example of a golf course in the world where the members take great pride in the uniqueness of their greens. And you have to figure them out. And so hopefully some of that's here at Peacock.
Sounds like a lot of three putts going on.
Well.
Is that how you make a course more challenging, that you have a course that's already existing?
No, I don't think. We're not looking for three putts. Of course, three putts are part of the game. You know.
Yeah.
But what we're looking for is, again, a puzzle that needs to be figured out at the green level. And so any green in the world could be three-putted. You know, it's a matter of the golfer and perhaps the conditions. But here at Peacock, if you don't think carefully about how you're coming into a green and where you leave yourself, sure, you could.
But when you have dimples and multiple levels and, you know, running through the center, these swales.
Well, except
through.
the greens are in defense of them. And, you know, the greens are big enough that you really have, when you have levels and big movement in the green, you really aren't just talking about a green. You're talking about three greens in one or two greens in one. Like number six, for example, is a dual level green. If the pin's on one level and you've hit to the other level, well, you've executed the shot very poorly. You know what I mean?
So, right.
And that doesn't mean, though, that you can't still make birdie. And it doesn't mean you can't make par. And it also doesn't mean that you can't possibly three putt and make your bogey. But
how does that impact pace of play?
Well,
because I know that's going to be an issue here, that they're going to want to try to promote pace of play.
Pace of play is a matter of not only how you manage a course, but it's also a matter of how you set it up for the golfer. And a lot of times in pace of play, we're not looking for fast as much as we're looking for an even, consistent pace. Because at Pebble Beach, for example, a five-hour round at Pebble Beach is not a bad thing if you're not having to wait on every shot. What better place, you know, could you relax?
Exactly.
What golfers have perceived time and actual time.
Okay.
And what they feel when they leave a golf course, if it's 4 hours and 20 minutes, they can still feel that the pace was terrible if they had to wait on the par three. So there's actually, when we set up a course, there's actually a reason, for instance, to if the 16th hole here, for example, which is a huge green, has a little slower pace rating, we actually might want to set up the 15th hole to be a more difficult hole to take longer to play. Why? So that we don't have people waiting at the 16th tee. Does that make sense? So it doesn't mean that we want the course. We do want the course and the golfers to finish quickly. How does it affect pace of play? Certainly, putting can be a part of pace. But what you find is actually there's more time on putts that don't have noticeable breaks, because those are the hardest ones to figure out. If it's a big, bold break, pretty easy to see whether the ball is going to go left or right, whether it's going to go fast or slow. So in defense, again, of bold contours on greens, I think it's a misnomer that they create longer time putting. They're actually, in many ways, easier to figure out, in many cases, not in every case.
All right, here's your chance. You're up, clubs in your hand. Go ahead and elicit the invitation for people to come out and see the new Peacock app.
Well, again, I think it's all the fun. That's the best way I could describe it. We've created a classic golf course that has traditional values, but a classic feel, and something that's also fun, interesting, one of a kind. You won't see some of these greens anywhere else. And you're in a beautiful surrounding right near the city. So
so if you're traveling to San Francisco and you're getting the opportunity to bring your golf clubs and you have the opportunity to play three rounds of golf in the San Francisco immediate Bay Area, and I'm not talking about going out of Pebble, okay?
Right.
So maybe you get to play San Francisco, you get to play Marin, you get to play the East Bay.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead and give me three courses to invite people to.
Well, some of them are private, which wouldn't be fair. But
No, don't do that.
I think in terms of San Francisco itself, one of the most fascinating golf courses in the city is Lincoln Park, just because it's basically the analogy. It's a direct cousin to the streets of San Francisco. I mean, here's this little funky, quirky golf course that goes up and goes down, and it's literally like riding a cable car with golf clubs in your hand.
That's true. I'm really surprised you didn't say Harding Park, but that's okay.
Well,
I love Lincoln. So.
I think Lincoln is just, to me, if I was, and it has the greatest view of Golden Gate Bridge of any golf course in the world. I think let's put Peacock in there because, you know, you can make the trip up here to Marin and you got a course the public can get on, you know, with advanced calling times. It is open to the public. And I think in over in the East, you know, you've got so many rich golf courses to choose from. I'll tell you one that's interesting, that's sort of fallen off the radar scope, is the old Alameda Municipal Course. And the reason I say that is because, you know, there's a golf course that just reeks of tradition, and it's simple, and it's kind of like walking back in time a little bit. And it's, I think, a bargain. I don't want to misquote the price, but I think for certainly under $30, you know, you can take your clubs out there and get a pull cart and walk around.
You love the history of the game, don't you?
I do. I think also there's a... You know, I mean, I think great golf is is the course, but it's also the whole experience. So you plop yourself into a golf game, and that's what's exciting about Peacock is the plans for the clubhouse and everything, you know, to eventually refurbish it. We'll create an experience here that's, again, someone can walk into, and it's kind of like walking back in time.
And the future of the game?
The future of the game in general?
Yeah.
I hope we're returning to some of the values that golf was known for. I think that from an environmental point of view, brown needs to be considered beautiful in terms of golf. We need to dry up our courses and stop over watering and over caring for them. And I think the return to fun is important. And I also think there's a lot of, if I had to make some predictions, and I have, and I'll go on record here, I think you're going to see a return to nine-hole rounds and nine-hole golf courses. I think there's a tremendous market out there in this time-urgent world for people to play nine-hole rounds, which was a part of America in the early days of golf all through the 60s. And then somewhere in the 70s, someone said, you're not serious unless you have an 18-hole golf course.
And they bought it.
They did buy it, which was good for my industry. But I really do see a return to the developer saying, you know what, we really only need nine holes. Let's go with that.
Forrest, thank you so much for spending this time. Absolutely fascinating. I really learned a lot. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
And Routing the Golf Courses is one of your books. You have others?
The other book is Bunkers, Pits, and Other Hazards that I wrote with Mark Fine. And then we have Routing the Golf Course, so those two books.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Golf Smarter now presents Nick's Picks with Kenny Nicholson, sales manager for EdwinWattsGolf.com. Kenny keeps us up to date with reviews of new products and new product development. Nick's Picks is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968.
Kenny Nicholson, how are you?
I'm good, Fred. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. I know this is a very special time around the Nicholson household, especially the Nicholson office. Happy Hanukkah, my friend. Today is the first. Tonight is the first night of Hanukkah, and I want to make sure that everybody is shopping at Edwin Watts Golf to start the holiday season.
Happy Hanukkah to you too, Fred.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Hey, how about, you know, people are shopping. They need new gear. What do you got to review for us? Let's talk about some new product that's out there.
Well, typically what you used to find in the past is new products only came out once a year, which was in January at the PGA show. Now you get a lot of new products in the fall as well as the spring. So there are quite a few new products out. One I wanted to touch base on, which I had a chance to hit this past week, was the new Mizuno MP600 driver, which was awesome.
Another high MOI driver?
Very high MOI. The revolutionary part of this driver is the new, what they call, fast track technology, where a lot of the drivers you see now have movable weight technology, and you have different weight ports, and you have to buy different weights and right. And put them in these weight ports and move them around to be able to adjust ball flight, and also whether you want to set it up for a draw or a fade type model. And what Mizuno has come out with is called a fast track technology. And inside the head cover, there's a little pocket where this Allen wrench fits. And you simply take that Allen wrench out, and it has two weights that are on what I call a slide technology. You can just simply loosen them up and slide them to a certain number position on the driver. To be able to increase whether it's toe weight or heel weight. If you move the weight towards the heel, obviously you're going to create a more draw-type driver. And if you move the weight towards the toe, you're going to create a driver that has a little bit more of a fade technology to it. And then it also has highlighted the two areas if you want to set it up for just a neutral type driver as well. And if you move them to those areas, you could also, it moves the center of gravity deeper and further back in the driver to give you a little more lift on the ball. So a lot of different trajectory changes, a lot of different closure changes. What I found the most, and I typically find this with Mizuno products, the club, when you set it up behind the golf ball, aesthetically is absolutely gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Looking driver. It sets up very, what I call, square. When you look down at it, you feel like you can actually work the ball a little bit with the driver. You know, some drivers set up real closed, And they have to, because drivers are so big these days, they have to close the toe down some in order to bring the club head back to squared impact. But for some people, it's an adverse look to them. They don't like it as much because they feel like they're just going to absolutely hook the ball at impact, where in essence, the toe is really slow on some of these larger drivers, so they do that to help get the club head to square. I really enjoyed it. It's one of those type clubs. It's with the fast track technology, you can try different things really quick and easy on the driving range. One thing to keep in mind, don't adjust it on the golf course.
If you're playing
in a tournament.
Well, see, I'm sitting here listening with this scowl on my face. And I just don't get it. I mean, is this something you want to change with after you hit the ball and you're not hitting it the way you want? So you make changes, and then, of course, you're not going to be hitting it the way you want, and then you make more changes all during a round? Or when do you change these weights?
If you're out, I mean, on the driving range is really the only place where you can change the weights, under USGA rules. Now, let's just say you go out for a practice round with your buddies or whatever, you don't have anything on the line, you're just out there having fun, and you want to try some different things on the golf course, and by all means, if you got a dog leg right, throw the weight towards the toe if you're a right-handed golfer, to slow the toe down and try to play a little fade out there and see how it works for you. But typically what you do is before your round, you set the driver up to the way that you need it. I find myself personally, I try to get the club to hit the ball as straight as I can on the driving range. And then on the golf course, if you need to play a little bit of a draw or a little bit of a fade, you know, that's one of those things you just need to be able to practice to be able to use on the golf course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't go out there on the golf course and say, okay, I got a dog leg left, I need to play a hook here, let me adjust this golf club to be able to hit a hook, and then the next hole is a dog leg right, you need to hit on the fade, so you're going to go ahead and adjust it again. You know, under the USGA rules, you cannot do that. What I typically like to do is I like to set a driver up to where I'm hitting it. I can make an aggressive swing at it, and I hit the ball as straight as I possibly can, and that's where I lock the driver into. And then whenever I go out on the golf course, if I have to hit a certain shot, I feel like setting it up square, and if I need to hit a fade, take the club outside just a little bit on the backswing, what I call the takeaway, and I typically can hit a little bit more of a fade. And if I want to hit a draw, I try to take the club on the inside just a little bit, and I find myself being able to hit a little bit of a draw. That's what I try to look at whenever I'm doing it. So, I mean, everybody's a little bit different, but the thing to keep in mind is if you're playing a golf course that has a lot of dog leg rights, and you know it has a lot of dog leg rights, you might want to add a little bit more of the weight towards the toe to be able to work a fade a little bit easier. I mean, technology's just changed so much. Most drivers have some movable weight technology. Some don't. The movable weight's great because you can set it up, you know, how you play. But if you're a known slicer of the golf ball, if you always hit the ball, you're right-handed and always goes out there and ends up in the right woods or the right fairway, there's some out there that they're just basically draw bias drivers.
You get fitted for something like that and have the guy tell you, you know what, you continue to hook the ball like that, so we should put you in a driver that will compensate for that?
Correct, and there are drivers that are made to compensate for that. Let's face it, not everybody can go out there and say, okay, I want to play a draw on this hole and play a draw, and I need to play a fade on this hole and play a fade.
Especially with a driver. You can't predict what every shot's going to be with your
A lot of people, the majority of them just want to hit the fairway. I just want to find the fairway. I don't care about working the ball.
Mm-hmm.
So getting fitted for the driver is the best thing to do. And whether it's the high percentage of those need a draw bias driver, the high percentage of the players out there. Because typically what you find is the majority of them slice the golf ball, whether it's a swing flaw or what have you. So getting fitted is the best thing to do.
Isn't this going to introduce more problems than it solves? This option of being able to change it as often as they want?
Well, I mean, it's been around for a few years now.
Yeah, Mizuno's not the first one to do the change.
No,
of
not
weights.
Not at all. Exactly.
Do a lot of companies do that?
There are several. There's three or four out there that do that. But you know what you find, you have the luxury of moving weight as you become better. Let's say you start hitting your drive really good, and now you want to play with it a little bit. Instead of having to go out and buy a brand new driver that sets up a different way, you're afforded the luxury of being able to just move some weights and trying something different. See, so there is a cost effect there, I would say. You know, if you all of a sudden you've bought a draw driver and now you're hooking the ball some because your swing's changed, or you've gotten a lot better with your driver, and instead of hitting that little draw out there, you want to be able to try to, you know, hit a little straighter or play a little fade. You know, with these drivers, you're able to just move some weight and change the dynamics of the driver a great deal. You know, that being said, you don't want to get out there, I think, and start moving weights all the time. I think you want to set it up to the way that you can play it the best and try to leave it there.
Then what's the point? You know, then why buy a driver that does that?
Because there are, when you become very proficient with the driver, you're able to set it up for particular golf courses, I would say.
Okay.
You know, I mean, every course is going to be a little bit different, and you know those. You know, we have some here that predominantly have dog leg rights, just the way the course is set up, and you can set it up for that type golf course. But typically, I don't find myself moving the weights once I set it up to the way that I like it. But it is very neat to be able to do that.
Now, you talk to consumers all the time, especially people who buy these removable weight clubs. What's the feedback that you get on these, and how many returns do you? I mean, people call and go, you know what, this thing's driving me crazy, I can't stand it, or this is the greatest invention ever. What do you get?
Yeah, believe it
or
not, the pros outweigh the cons.
Really?
10 to 1. Yeah, I mean, it's just because they typically can set the golf club up to where they can actually play it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the thing.
In all skill levels, we're talking about, right?
In all skill levels,
okay.
Correct. Whether they, you know, buy a little bit heavier gram weight on a certain driver, and they've cured their slice now. You know, there's a huge advantage to having these. Yeah, there are some adverse effects if somebody's trying to do too many things with the driver and they're hitting it just all over the place. The thing is being able to find the common ground for just getting the ball in the fairway and setting the driver up for that. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of advantages to having the slide weight, the fast track technology or movable weight technology. But then again, there are a lot of manufacturers that don't believe in it, and all they do is they have a driver that sets up for a specific skill level, and they go with that, and they've been very successful with that as well.
Well, now you have choices.
Exactly.
All right, so the Mizuno MP600 with fast track, right? Driver. What are they going for these days? What is it coming out of the box?
They're coming out of the box at $399.99.
So they're competitively priced.
They are very competitively priced, and we've got a lot
to choose from.
Yeah, if you go to our website, edmundwattsgolf.com, we've got a lot of drivers on sale right now as well.
And is Mizuno one of the companies that restricts our 10% discount for our listeners?
No, Mizuno is one that we cannot do that on. They do have a new MAP policy in place, and which is good for us in the retail side of it, not so much for the consumer side of it, but it helps us out in the long run.
All right, so you cannot get 10% off, but you can get free shipping.
Unfortunately, there's certain manufacturers that there are restrictions on everything that we do, and that's
really
for the manufacturer to do that. Don't look at us as the bad guy here or the manufacturer. It's a distribution issue where the manufacturers that are authorized dealers, they want everybody to play by the same rules, and it comes down to customer service for the most part. And if you ever have an issue, we've been around since 1968, and we can get that resolved for you.
Yeah.
We stand behind their products and the products that we sell with a 2-year manufacturer's warranty. There's a lot of advantages. It's good for us, trust me when I say that, and everybody will agree. If you look at, real quick, if you look at electronics side of it, if you look at Apple, if you look at Bose speakers, companies like that, it doesn't matter where you shop, everything's going to be the same price.
Mm-hmm.
They do a real, real good job of that. Now it comes down to where do you feel comfortable shopping?
Right.
And me personally, I think that that's a really good thing. You know?
Well, I'll tell you, based on the emails that I receive from the listeners who have done some shopping at Edwin Watts Golf, the thing that comes back time and time again is the customer service has been phenomenal. So
yeah,
you know,
pride ourselves in that,
so it doesn't matter where you buy. You know, it doesn't matter where you buy your club. It's going to be the exact same price. So now it comes down to what you get with it, which is your customer service. You know, it's interesting because people have asked me a long time, whether I should buy a Mac or should I buy a Windows machine. And I say, you know, it doesn't matter what the speed is or how big your hard drive is. It matters when something goes wrong with it, which one's easier to fix. And do you have to take it in or can you do it yourself? And it always comes back even... And I'm not a computer expert, but even the computer experts agree that generally Mac is an easier thing to deal with. But that's off topic. But it really is value add after.
It is,
make
but
a purchase.
It is, but it relates to what we're dealing with this, you know, customer service issues.
Yeah,
and I think you're
absolutely
right. So.
Well, the one thing Edwin Watts Golf does do that no one else does is they give away product here on the Golf Smarter podcast and transition segue. And we are giving away this. I love this gift. This is the bag of your choice from OGIO. So if you want a stand bag or a cart bag or a travel bag or a duffel bag, if OGIO makes it and Edwin Watts Golf carries it and you win, you can pick whatever you want, right?
That's a wonderful giveaway.
It's a wonderful giveaway. And we have received 194 entries. I have sorted them randomly. And you, my friend, get to be the one who picks the name. You have from 1 to 194. You can pick number 1. You can pick number 194. Or you can pick anything in between. And that number will be?
I'm going to do 12. There we go. Not at the bottom.
No, I think you're doing the best job that you can with this. And... the winner is going to be from Texas, McKinney, Texas. Bill Spansel is our winner today of the OGIO bag of his choice. Bill, congratulations.
Congratulations. He's right there near Dallas where we've got some retail locations.
So you can go in and you can either look online at edwinwattsgolf.com or you can go into the store and check out and play with the bag, see what one feels like, write down the model number and get back to me and we will make sure this gets shipped out to you. Bill Spansel, congratulations of McKinney, Texas.
Congratulations, Bill.
But we're not done. I think before the Christmas holiday arrives, we can do one more giveaway for this year. And can we do that, please?
Yeah, we can.
Okay.
Actually,
and
I have that in my budget. So
awesome.
And I had one of my buddies in here.
Thank you
the
for
other
pulling
day.
Out of your budget, by the way, to do this. I appreciate this.
No, but I had one of my buddies in here the other day. Reed Gorman, he's the president of McGregor Golf, and he said, "Hey, I'd like to be a part of this and give away
really?
A driver." Yeah, so
these guys are hearing about what we're doing.
They are. They
that's
like it.
So cool.
So we're going to give away a McGregor NVG2 driver of your choice, whether that be a tour driver, a draw bias driver, whatever you need, we can set you up with it.
Wow, very cool. All right, the McGregor MacTac NVG2 driver, and the deadline for entries is noon on Monday, December 17th, 2007. We'll announce the winner on the show that is published on December 18th, 2007. And to enter, please go to golfsmarterpodcast.com and click on the word contest just below the Edwin Watts Golf banner. Once you're there, fill out the shipping information and the verification code and then click submit. And while you're on that page, you can also see the prizes that we've given away and who has won each prize. So if you want to check if you've won, that's a great place to do it. And I also will accept your emails and your questions and your comments. Please send them to me while you're there. And if you have a question for Kenny about some equipment or shipping or anything else or a new piece of gear that you've heard about and you want to know more, there's an Ask Kenny button at golfsmarterpodcast.com. And please go ahead and fill that out. And if we use your question on the program, we'll send you a free Golf Smarter Edwin Watts Golf hat. And while you're shopping, Kenny, we should remind them that while they're shopping, they get 10% off and free shipping as a Golf Smarter listener. And if you want all the information on that while you're at the golfsmarterpodcast.com site, click on the Edwin Watts Golf banner and it'll give you all the details on how to do that. Kenny, thank you so much. Interesting comments about this, the new Mizuno MP600 driver. I appreciate it. Good education. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, friend. I enjoyed it myself.
And thanks again to Forrest Richardson of Forrest Richardson and Associates. You can check out his books, his writings, and his portfolio at golfgroupltd.com. Not sure if their new website is ready yet, but Peacock Gap Country Club and Spa includes a renovation of the 33,000-square-foot clubhouse and the building of a new spa, swimming pool, and exercise facility that will adjoin the existing clubhouse area. And when all this is done in early 2009, they will have sunk $30 million into the property. Personally, I've always liked having Peacock Gap around as an ego boost. Whenever I wasn't playing well, I'd head out to Peacock and shoot in the 80s and feel like a stud. After playing the new course, I have to say that I can't wait to go back. My ego was seriously bruised out there because I took the course for granted. Even though the course is only 6,261 yards from the tips, all the new greens demand your very best play, and target golf is in order. The condition is fabulous, and the work that Forrest has done really brings out your best strategic game. I played with my friend Scott Clark of LostBall.com, who's a 3.2, and John Leland of TheJoyOfGolfing.com blog. You can read John's review of Peacock Gap from November 28th. But I think that we all agree that we enjoyed the course and would come back many, many more times. This week's quote comes from longtime listener and world traveler Paul Salemba, who offers a great line from Ben Hogan for everyone who chooses not to put their sticks away after the conclusion of daylight savings time. Hogan once said that, quote, "The only thing a golfer really needs is more daylight." If you have any questions, comments, quotes, or requests, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarterpodcast.com.
The Good Dog Podcast is for people who are passionate about dogs.
I love my dogs.
I interview veterinarians, dog behaviorists, and a whole range of experts who offer tips and insights.
A good German Shepherd makes decisions. It will say, well, you know, I know the light just changed, but on the other hand, there's a very quiet Prius coming your way, and so I'm going to stop, whereas labs have a tendency to just follow rules.
You'll hear about some amazing canines who help their owners to be safe, and in some cases, a lot.
Sometimes diabetics will test and they'll still be at 100 saying, I'm not going low, what are you talking about? And the dogs let them know before they even feel it.
And you'll pick up ideas for solving a host of challenges.
Within a week, you're going to have a dog that is calm, he lies down quietly, he's just going to be a totally different dog.
I'm Joanne Green. Please subscribe to the Good Dog Podcast, found in iTunes or at smarterpodcasts.com.